Quaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 185, and it's the second in the series titled Irish Slaves to Irish Gangs to Cops. Now, before we get into it, I have to do a little bit of business here. I've been talking about this Lemonade Freedom Day that's going to be happening on August 18th. So I'm not going to read the whole thing. I just want to urge you to get over to Lemonade Freedom Day's website and just scroll down the page. You can get all the details there. This is going to happen Saturday, August 18th. There's also some activities Friday evening on the 17th. Either Friday the 17th or Saturday the 18th, we're going to try to get a streaming live link on badquaker.com so that you can watch the events. And we're going to ask if the authorities decide to get rough and start grabbing people and pushing them around and doing what they do, then if you're watching on the live stream, we're going to have phone numbers for you to call and demand that the protesters be treated civilly, because we want all the protesters in the event to remain calm and not to resist in any way and not be a fuss. We want, if people are going to be roughed up over raw milk and lemonade, then we want the world to see that in a true light. We want the world to see the brutality of the state. So if you're watching on the live stream and you see brutality happening, then we're going to give you the police phone number so that you can call and report that brutality and say, hey, these guys in costumes are roughing up these regular people who are just drinking milk and having lemonade. So I'm going to breeze past that for today. There, you can get more on that at Lemonade Freedom Day's website, and that's lemonadefreedomday.com, or you can just Google Lemonade Freedom Day. I went over this yesterday. I want to touch it again today. We are going to be, we're trying to set up a page on badquaker.com, and it'll be called something like Ben's Suggested Books, or Ben's Book List, or Ben's Reading List, or something like that. And we're going to have it separated with topics and subtopics, and it's going to be books that I use and refer to and own, and that way you can kind of get an idea of where I'm getting my information. And also, if I'm referring to a book, it'll probably be on that list, and there'll be links from there where you can click on them and go to Amazon and buy them. And for today's continuation of yesterday's topic on the relationship between crime gangs in the U.S. and police forces, my sources for this, again, are going to be Conceived in Liberty by Murray Rothbard, The Gangs of New York, An Informal History of the Underworld by Herbert Asbury, 1928, and Wikipedia. And I once again want to give a quick explanation of revisionist history, because a lot of people, once this gets published, a lot of people are going to be more concerned with this episode of the podcast than the last one. The last one was laying the foundation of how the Irish came into North America, the difference between the so-called Scotch-Irish, the Ulster Scots, and the what might be called the true Irish, which were mostly Catholic Irish. And that was mostly what episode one of this discussion was about. Episode two is going to be more to the point of how the gangs formed in the New World, in North America, and specifically in the cities like New York and Boston and so forth. and how they moved into polite society, and how the gangs themselves literally became the police forces of the big cities in the East. And so I believe this episode is going to be the more controversial of the two. To get the full impact of what I'm saying in this, you really need to listen to the first one as well. But I think this one is going to be the one that's going to, wrinkle people a bit. So for that reason, I'm repeating the things that I said yesterday, because I think a lot of people are going to hear this one that didn't hear the one yesterday. So now, revisionist history. Let me give my quick explanation of revisionist history, and longtime listeners know that I use this quite frequently. If you take an author like Steinbeck, Steinbeck was writing about what he was seeing firsthand. And in generations to come, and to a certain extent even right now, Steinbeck's writings are considered history and will be considered history in the future. The problem with that is Steinbeck was a communist, and Steinbeck wrote everything with a communist twist and with the purpose of convincing people towards communism. Now, if you dispute that, crack open a book. But the fact is, whether you like Steinbeck or not, That was his goal, his intention. Steinbeck was a communist. Everything he wrote was communist propaganda. Now, that doesn't mean everything he wrote was a lie. There was lots of true stuff in what he was writing. But everything he wrote had that tilt to it. And you find this at any particular time in history. Writers that we look back on and say, well, this guy was writing about history. There's particular tilts in why they were writing what they were writing. People are not pure. And historians are not pure. And people writing history, they're not pure. And they tend to write into their narrative their own preconceived notions. And this is the case with Steinbeck. And my example was, when I was a teenager, I read Grapes of Wrath. And I'm reading along in Grapes of Wrath, and he says, he's talking about the folks from Oklahoma. And he says they had this quaint custom where they chewed their food with their front teeth, a custom. And you see, that tells me Steinbeck's an idiot, because the fact is, they chewed with their front teeth because they had no back teeth. But he didn't bother to examine that, you see. He just assumed it was some kind of a local thing, a custom. No, they were poor. They were dirt farmers in Oklahoma and Arkansas and Missouri and Kansas. They were dirt poor. They had lived on stone ground wheat and stone ground corn, and this had taken all the enamel off of their molars. And so by the time they're about 35 or 40, they don't have molars. Their front teeth is all they have. And that's why they ate with their front teeth, Steinbeck. And I knew that when I was a teenager, when I read Steinbeck's explanation of that. So here's the thing about revisionist history. I look at what Steinbeck wrote, and I don't just discard it. I look beyond what he intended to tell me, and I see what he was seeing with his eyes, and I use my own brain, and I use logic, and I use the writings of other contemporaries of the day, and I figure out what was really going on. Steinbeck doesn't have to tell me that they ate stone ground corn and stone ground wheat. I know that from other sources, and I know from other sources that this has a tendency to take the enamel off of your molars. So I put together the things that I know to be facts, and I put that together with Steinbeck's eyewitness account, and I reject his conclusion and I draw my own, and that's what revisionist history is. So, for example, I used this example yesterday. I've spent hours and hours and hours reading George Washington's personal letters that are in they're available online in the Library of Congress and several other sources. And the whole time I'm reading Washington's letters, I'm realizing that these letters are the words of George Washington trying to convince somebody of something. So to start with, I'm not buying his little stories. I'm trying to look beyond that and see what he's talking about, who he's talking to, and see how his letters change when he's talking to one guy as opposed to talking to somebody else. And I get a glimpse into the mind of George Washington by doing this. This is the way I figure out things in history. Yes, I do read a lot of Murray Rothbard stuff like Conceived in Liberty, and I take a lot of what Murray says very, very seriously. But even with Murray Rothbard, you see a tilt in a particular direction with Murray Rothbard's writings. So I'm very careful about that, and I'm very careful to bump it off of other things. Okay, now let's jump into a real quick review of what I went through yesterday, and this is just a very quick overview. I'm not going to really emphasize any points. If you start to do research of the origin of police in the U.S., what you're going to find almost entirely is prepackaged state myths. That's all you're going to find. You have to get in beyond what is being sold to you by the state. And if you research the origins of gangs in the U.S., typically what you find is that the narrative begins way after the fact. They want to start talking about gangs in the U.S. mostly like in the 1920s or in the 1950s or in the 1970s. You're hundreds of years too late when you do that. All right, so now yesterday I talked about from the 16 to the 1700s, the Irish immigrations into North America. And I talked about the difference between the Ulster Scots or the Scot-Irish, also those from Northern Ireland, typically Presbyterian, and the what might be called the true Irish or the native Irish, typically Catholic Irish, that were from other parts of Ireland. And the tendency of the Ulster Scots, once they got here, almost all of these were brought over as bound servants, which is virtually no different from slavery. There's practically no difference between a indentured servant and a slavery, and I went over that yesterday. Specifically, that the indentured servants were over 90% of all slaves and indentured servants together were Irish back in the 16 and 1700s. And because of the English bigotry, and keeping in mind the colonies were English, because of the English bigotry, these Irish were not considered, they were considered like a subculture. They weren't considered as good as the English, as the proper culture was. So mostly the Puritans in the North had no problem at all, you know, any kind of trumped up charges they could put on these Irish indentured servants, they would, and then they would find them guilty of the crime and sentence them to another 8 or 10 years of being an indentured servant. So it was a nonstop thing. It was just like slavery. It was basically slavery. However, in the South, you didn't have that so much because there were no Puritans in the South. The plantation owners and the rich people in the South that owned indentured servants had a tendency to be honest with them and allow them to earn their freedom and allow them even to own property and so forth like this. So mostly all the slaves and indentured servants together, about 90% of them were Irish, only about 2% African, and about 8% other. And that was the case well up into the mid to late 1700s. Then we have, in the mid-1700s, we have the War of Independence. At the end of the War of Independence, the North outlawed slavery, but they didn't outlaw servitude. And this is really kind of a moot point. They did it to shut up the Quakers, because the Quakers were against slavery. So it was a political action. It was a trick of the state. So the North outlaws slavery, but there were virtually no slaves in the North. So it meant almost nothing. What it really did, And this is evident, especially if you read some of the writings of some of the Puritan masters, so-called. What it really did was it ensured that there would be no African slaves imported into the Northeast. You see, that was the real point of outlawing slavery in the North. It wasn't because all of a sudden the Puritans realized slavery was bad. That wasn't it at all, because they still owned they still used servitude. They still owned indentured servants. So it wasn't about slavery as we know it. It was about keeping African slaves out of the North, because the Puritans, though they looked down their nose at the Irish as a subclass of citizens, the Puritans looked down their nose at the Africans as subhuman. And that's the real difference. The Puritans didn't want Africans in the North American continent at all. And you can see this later on when people like Abraham Lincoln and others try to deport, or it's their plan. He didn't actually live long enough to do it, but it was Lincoln's plan to deport the African slaves from the South, after conquering the South, it was his intent to deport them back to Africa again because he hated them. See, that's the real truth that's hidden from history. But you can read it in Lincoln's writings. He was fairly clear about it. Okay, but let's get back to the recap now. So through the 1700s, we have the War of Independence, and slavery is outlawed in the North, but that's just a trick. Now, I wanted to read something that I didn't get to in the first one. Actually, I skipped over it. This is from Murray Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, and I'm going to read the writings of a guy named... Well, I'm going to read what Murray Rothbard says about Cotton Mather. Cotton Mather was the son of Increase Mather and the grandson of John Cotton and Richard Mather. And these were all considered prominent Puritan ministers, and they were all big shots among the Puritans. So this is from Murray Rothbard. He says, "The Reverend Cotton Mather, always an eloquent and leading spokesman for despotism, warned the slaves and the servants in a sermon that..." And he quotes here, "There's a fondness for freedom in many of you." Mather advised the slaves that they were living better materially than they would be under freedom. Furthermore, slavery had been appointed for them by God. Singing for others the siren song of supposedly content and blissful security, Mather purred, quote, "Your servitude is gentle. You are treated with more than mere humanity, and fed and clothed and lodged as well, and quote, "Your servitude is gentle. You're treated with more than mere humanity, and fed and clothed and lodged as well as you can wish for, and you have no cares upon you. You only have to come when you're called and to do what you're bidden. That's the end of the quote there. All of the subjects must do, in short..." Oh, I see. "All the subjects must do, in short, was to surrender their natural-born gift of freedom and independence, to subject themselves completely to the whims and commands of others, who could then be blindly trusted to take care of them permanently." So that's Murray talking about Cotton Mather. So you see the condescending attitude that Cotton Mather had in reference to the slaves and indentured servants. And keep in mind, he's talking almost entirely about the Irish there. Okay, and so then from late 1700s to the early 1800s, African slaves began to be imported into the South in heavier numbers. But it was still the Irish that were moving into the North. Now, at this part, I should mention that there's an exception to this, to everything that I'm saying. There's an exception, and that is New Orleans. New Orleans is the exception to everything that I'm saying this, because at the time, New Orleans was not a part of the U.S. So everything that I'm talking about the South doesn't apply to New Orleans. So now, there was a slowdown in the Irish slaves after the War of Independence. A lot of the rich people specifically in New England, had been cut off from their political ties to the English that were dominating the Irish countryside. So it was a lot harder to use the political connections and kidnap Irishmen and bring them over into servitude. The old process was that an English person in the colonies would get a hold of an English person dominating the Irish countryside and say, "Hey, I need five guys," and so five young Irish men would be arrested on some charges and found guilty and sentenced to prison, and then they could be purchased out of that prison as essentially slaves and sent to the New World, where they could be worked indefinitely, really. But that tie was severed after the War of Independence. Okay, now I'm going to break for a commercial. Stick with me, I'll be right back.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And I was talking about the time frame between the mid-1700s and the mid-1800s, and we're going to move ahead from there. But before I do, let's jump in a boat and leave North America and take a quick visit to Ireland. Ireland from 1600 to 1800 was almost endless war. There was constant oppression. The English were dominating the countryside and dominating the Irish, taking their property away, refusing to allow them to own property. There was a thing called the penal laws, which disarmed the Irish. And this was the Catholic Irish and the Presbyterian Irish. So we're talking about the Ulster Scots and we're talking about the Irish proper. The penal laws were used to keep them from owning property, keep them from arming themselves, to keep them beat down so that they weren't allowed to be involved in the military. There were all kinds of rules in this. Now, in 1800, Ireland lost the last thread of its self-rule, and it really wasn't self-rule because it was really the English lords that were dominating the Irish countryside. But in 1800, the Act of the Union, or Act of Union, was passed by Parliament in England, and it took away the last of the powers of independent Irish rule, and it put Parliament in London in charge, directly in charge of Ireland. Now, so you have these disarmed Irish. Oh, I wanted to mention, too, you know, when they disarmed the Irish, it produced an odd thing called the shillelagh. I don't know if you're familiar with a shillelagh, but a shillelagh is basically a club. It's kind of like you can make the excuse that it's a walking stick, except it's typically made out of a hardwood, and the handle part of it is typically oversized. And what they would often do is drill it out and fill it full of lead so it would be heavier. So basically you're talking about a club or a long-handled hammer. And they would rub it all down. They would use hardwood, and then they would rub it all down with butter. And they would put it up in their up high in their chimney where it would be dry, where it would dry and where it would be seasoned. And the tannins and the tars and so forth would get into that wood, and it would typically make the shillelagh like shiny black, and they would bring it out and polish it all up, and it was, there were somewhat more beautiful, but it was a nasty weapon, and that was what the Irish carried because they weren't allowed to carry firearms. So they were a disarmed people, and there was not a whole lot they could do about the dominance that the English nobility had over them. So from 1800 to about 1840. Let me back up. In 1800, when the Act of Union was passed, it kind of disarmed. It took a lot of the power away from the English lords that were holding control in Ireland, and so there was kind of a little bit of an uprising going on right after 1800. And so these English lords that were dominating Ireland, they started to appeal to Parliament, saying, you know, well, we got the lawless going on, we can't control these crazy Irishmen. Well, something else was going on at the same time. Between 1800 and 1840 in Ireland, the Industrial Revolution was hitting. And so after 1800, waves and waves of people of Irish were coming out of the countryside and coming into the cities to work the newly built factories. There were all kinds of textile factories and all kinds of other factories popping up in the cities in Ireland. And so the poor were flooding into the cities, leaving the countryside and coming in for the work in the factories. Well, the problem with that, you know, if you were a rich English or you were even rich upper class Irish and you were living in the cities, And they would build these factories on the outskirts of the city. And then all these poor people would come in from the countryside, and they're working in the cities with just barely making a living. But it's better than what they had out in the countryside. It's better than what they earned farming. So for the first time in their lives, these poor coming in from the countryside are making money like they've never made before, even though, you know, most people would think of it as just barely making enough to live. It was more than they had in the countryside. So they're happy. They're making money. They come into the cities. They get these factory jobs, and they do things that the proper city dwellers and the English ruling class didn't appreciate. Things like, you know, getting drunk and falling asleep in the curb, having prostitutes on the streets, getting in fist fights on the streets. This is just fun revelry that these poor people, who now were making money in the factory, it's just the normal thing that they do. And people who are more accustomed to living better look down their nose on that, and they say, well, you know, this has to be stopped. These people can't be out here in the street drinking and fighting and so forth. Well, in the past, that type of activity was held in check to a certain extent by the clan structure in Ireland. When there was no state in Ireland, which went on for thousands of years, when there was no state in Ireland, the clan system kept law and order, in a sense. But with 200 years of English domination, 200 years of poverty, 200 years of having the English destroying the clan system, there was then the English Parliament yanks out the ability of the English nobility in Ireland to actually enforce law, and all of a sudden for about 10 years there was nothing to control the poor people in Ireland as they're making more money and as their, you know, revelry and their, you know, playing in the streets and everything. Well, we can't have this. So the proper city dwellers and the English nobility complain to Parliament, and they're really upset because it's just lawlessness on the streets in Ireland. So we have a government solution. In 1813, you know, Harry Brown said this, he's passed now, but Harry Brown probably said this better than anybody else. He said, the government breaks your leg, then hands you a crutch, and says, see, without the government, you can't walk. Well, the English government broke Ireland's legs. And then in 1813, an Englishman named Robert Peel provided the solution to the Irish problem. Robert Peel, so-called Sir Robert Peel, he was the guy that invented police. Robert Peel is where you get the name Bobbies in England. Robert Peel had this idea, and he presented it to the English government. He would hire English thugs, big guys. He would hire them out of the bars and so forth like this. He would uniform them similar to military. You see, now, the English couldn't really move the military into Ireland to get control of this, because it really wasn't, you know, that level of a problem. It was drunks on the street. It wasn't revolution. And the English really didn't want any more war in Ireland. So they didn't want to provoke war by moving military troops in. But they needed to get the drunks off the street to satisfy the, you know, the proper city dwellers and the English nobility. So Robert Peel has the solution. He goes in among the English thugs, and he hires some big guys, and he puts them all in paramilitary uniforms. It's not really military uniforms, but it kind of has that flavor. And they're not armed with rifles and bayonets like the military is. They're just armed with clubs. They're armed with batons. And so in 1813, Robert Peel and his uniformed thugs with their batons, they go into the streets of the Irish cities, and they begin enforcing curfews, and they begin beating the mobs back into the slums where they belong. Those dirty Irish. We got to get them out of the streets and get them back into their slums. Now, make no mistake, it wasn't all of the city that were patrolled by Robert Peel and his thugs. They only patrolled the proper parts of the city, and they would beat the poor back into their own slums. And then if they want to lay around in the streets drunk or fist fight in the streets or whatever they want to do, that's fine in the slums. Just don't bring that in where the English and the proper city dwellers have to see it, you see? So it wasn't really about crime. It wasn't about investigating crime. It wasn't about enforcing the law. It was all about keeping the poor out of the visual sight of proper society. That was the purpose of Robert Peel and his bobbies. But it's okay, you see, because they're beating the Irish. It's okay to beat the Irish. They're dirty people anyway, aren't they? Right? That was the excuse. So it's okay for Robert Peel and his bobbies to go in and beat the poor back into the slums where they belong, because they're dirty, poor Irish. The problem is, by 1820, Peel was recruiting his English thugs to clear the streets and enforce the curfews and beat the mobs back into the slums of London. You see, once governments figured out that Peel's process worked in Ireland, they figured out that it worked in London, and it worked in Edinburgh, and it worked in Paris, and it worked in Munich. And pretty soon, it was going to work in New York and Boston. Let's go across the sea back to America. In 1820, government-backed canal building was all the rage in the northern states in America. There was a guy named Henry Clay. Now, he was from Kentucky, and if you go to school, if you go to public school in Kentucky, you're going to be hit with a barrage of praise for Henry Clay. But that's really foolish of Kentuckians to praise Henry Clay, because Henry Clay was basically a tool of the big bankers in New York City. And Henry Clay actually openly took huge payments from the bankers. And what he did, his signature activity, let's say, was to put upon the South high tariffs and force the South to foot the bill for these building projects in the northern states, mostly canal building. So Kentuckians shouldn't be proud of Henry Clay. He placed tariffs directly on their farms and their commerce and their exports. And the other thing that happened was, by all these government-funded canals in the northern states, it took commerce off the Ohio and Mississippi River and put them up into the Great Lakes to come down the Erie Canal and exit in New York City. So literally, Henry Clay and those that were like him that were doing what he was doing, what they were doing was they were taking the commerce out of cities like New Orleans and pushing it all towards New York with all the wealth that went with it. And he was taxing and tariffing the South to pay for all that activity. This is what Henry Clay did. And it was all financed by the central banking based in New York City. So all these boondoggles that Henry Clay and these other politicians were involved in with financing all these canals, it was all backed by the central bankers. The problem is with this that there was a shortage of cheap labor in the North at the time, and it didn't pay. You know, it used to pay to call somebody up. Well, they didn't call. They didn't have phones. But it used to pay to send a letter to some English nobility in Ireland and say, "Hey, send me 5 pressed guys over here," and they would do that. Like I was telling you a minute ago. But now this didn't pay to do that anymore, and they didn't have the connections to do it. But they still needed the labor. So rather than having indentured servants coming over 2 or 3 or 5 at a time, this was the age of the steamship. You see, it was 1819 when the, what was the name of that ship? I can't remember the name of the famous ship that crossed the Atlantic, the famous steamship that crossed the Atlantic in 1819. But as soon as that happened, waves of steamships started crossing back and forth across the Atlantic. And this brought the ability to bring in much larger ships, much faster, and bring in waves and waves of cheap Irish labor. Irish that were, you know, that were tired of getting beat up in the streets by the bobbies, and the factories were overflowed anyway with labor. And here's another thing to keep in mind. The population in Ireland between 1800 and 1840, 1800 and 1840, the population in Ireland doubled. So there was this huge influx of labor coming in the steamships into the north, into the northern states, by way of Ireland. And there was perfect jobs for them, all these government-backed building projects with the canals and so forth, all being paid for by the southern states. So as wave after wave after wave of Irish immigrants came in to provide labor for this, what actually happened was they intentionally imported too many of the Irish laborers. And I say intentionally because since they had too many, there was more labor than there were jobs. This kept the wages low. And the wonderful thing for England in all this was that London's Irish problem became the Yankee banker's Irish solution. You see, too many Irish in Ireland scared the English. But if they could export them to America, that solved the problem right there. So the Irish came flooding into Boston, New York, Philadelphia. Labor pools were controlled by community organizers, basically gang leaders, and the community organizers worked with the mayors and with the governors, who awarded the contracts to select corporations, select construction companies. Now I want to remind you, we're talking the 1820s or so, and at this time, there were no police in America. Constables served warrants and summons, but they had no police duties. Private investigators and private security firms worked with courts and federal marshals. Now, the federal marshals would go around and they would, you know, actually, the federal marshals would actually go around and do things like enforce taxes and things like this, but there were no police, and the federal marshals didn't really do police duty, and the constables had no police powers. This was called, in many references, you'll find this called the heyday, or the Hayes days, or the heydays. And the reason why is because of a famous constable named Jacob Hayes. So when you hear somebody say, well, that was the heydays, that's what they're talking about. That's where the phrase comes from. A constable named Jacob Hayes, who was the constable of New York City, for about 50 years. The reason it's called the heydays is because it was relatively peaceful in New York. There was really no crime. It was very safe. And with him being the constable with no police force whatsoever, he was the only constable for New York City for about 50 years. And it was considered a very peaceful time frame. So this brings us into the time frame of about 1835 to, let's say, 1850. And now we've got all these waves of Irish immigrants that have come in, and we've got these community organizers, which are basically gang leaders, and they are they're working with the mayors and the governors, and they're deciding who works, who doesn't work, and there's, you know, there's increasing levels of unemployment and underemployment, because we want to for the scheme to work, you have to have a lot of laborers available to keep the employment prices low. This is what you see if you go to some place like Home Depot in the Southwest. Now you see a whole pool of workers, and one contractor will pull up and need five guys. There's maybe 50 there. You see, this keeps this keeps those workers in a position where the employers have more power. Okay, so I'm going to break again, and when I come back, we're going to get into how this leap took place from the Irish gangs in the 1830s and how it became police forces. Hi folks, Ben Stone here from BadQuaker.com. I want to tell you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, they have video files, audio files, and you can participate in discussions online and in the discussion boards. These audio files are in MP3 format, so you can download them and take them with you. You can listen to them on your drive to and from work or any time that's convenient for you. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes they don't get the real story in government-approved schools and government-approved history. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers, but it's also good for anybody who wants to learn about liberty while avoiding state propaganda. Take this course, and Tom Woods and his team will equip you with one of the very best tools the liberty movement has to offer: knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. Now, who else are you going to find at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom? Kevin Gutzman, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, which is on my list of books, plus lots of other noted educators and students that will help guide you to your understanding of history and Austrian economics. So what is this kind of an education worth to you and your family? Well, at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for around $8 a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that will be added later in the future, the discussion forums, the optional live sessions, and reading suggestions. Now, how do you do this? Folks, go to badquaker.com. Click on the banner on the right-hand column where you see the ad for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using the link at badquaker.com, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. And once again, I want to point out this. I want to emphasize this point. There were no police in America prior to about 1835. There were constables. Every town, every city had a constable. Even big cities had a constable, one constable. And the constables served warrants and served summons, but had no police duties. Private investigators and private security firms worked with courts and federal marshals. Federal marshals took care of things like tax collection. They had no police duties. These were called the Haydays, named after Jacob Hay, the constable of New York. It was a good time. And I'm recapping like that because this podcast is put out on the radio, and some people come in at different points in it. So this is badquaker.com podcast, and getting back into our topic here. Now, 1835, right in that area, the first actual police forces started popping up in Boston and New York. And there was a reason for this. You see, gangs serve a purpose in a poor neighborhood. I know that doesn't sound logical, but they really do. Especially where there's no state involvement, where the state has pulled out of a neighborhood, a gang actually serves the community in many ways. And think of the mafia. You know, if you're paying your mafia person, if you're a businessman and you're paying your mafia guy a little cut of your business, nothing's going to happen to your business. Nobody's going to come rob you. Nobody's going to steal from you. Nobody's going to break your window because they've got the mafia to deal with if they do, so long as you keep your payments made to the mafia. That's what gangs do. I've encountered this with Hell's Angels and with Mongols out in California, where you go into a Hell's Angels bar, and it's the safest place in the world. Nobody is going to rob that bar because the Hell's Angels take care of it. Even if there's no Hell's Angels in the bar at that time, it doesn't matter. Nobody's going to mess with that bar. As a 15, 16-year-old, I was able to go into bars like that and play pool half the night and never worry about a cop and never worry about being endangered by anybody. Of course, I never tried to drink either, but it was still illegal for me to be in there. But as long as everybody knew that that was a bar that was covered by the Hell's Angels, you could have any collection of different people come and go in there, and there was always peace. Because that's what a gang provides for a neighborhood. Well, that's what the police... Well, let's get into this here. Now, the state solution is the police. In the 1835 to 1850 range, what started happening was, because you had this large pool of labor, and the governors and the mayors had been working with these community leaders, basically gang leaders, they had been working with the gang leaders to provide employment for the poor Irish that were living in the slums. Well, the problem is the people in the slums start spilling into the proper part of town. Now, like I said, the poor neighborhoods are already regulated by the gangs. That's their purpose in those neighborhoods. But when the poor start spilling out into the proper part of the city, remember what I was talking about, Dublin and the Irish cities. When these Irish poor in New York and in Boston and Philadelphia and other cities like that, in Baltimore, they start spilling out of the slums and wandering into the proper parts of the city. Well, those proper city dwellers can't have those dirty Irish walking around on their streets, being drunk in their streets, or having, you know, dancing in their streets, or having prostitutes, or just even walking around. They certainly don't want to have poor beggars in the streets of the proper part of town. So there's pressure put on the mayor, and the mayor needs to do something about the Irish that are spilling into the proper parts of town. What are they doing over there anyway? Why aren't they staying in their own neighborhoods? So the mayor needs to hire somebody. The mayor needs to hire somebody who can keep the poor in their own neighborhoods. Well, who are you going to hire for this? Well, he's going to work with the same people he's been hiring to do all the other road improvements and plumbing, you know, putting in the sewers and all those jobs. The mayor's been using the neighborhood coordinators, these gang, the gang leaders. And so he hires, right out of the gangs, he hires the Irish as the police. Now, these police are not in the slums. They're not down there in the slums keeping the poor off the street in the slums. These police are in the proper parts of town making sure that the dirty Irish stay in the slums. That's their purpose. That's the whole purpose of the mayor hiring the police, is to keep the Irish in the slums and keep them out of the main part of town. So then, they have to look nice for this. They can't look like bums. So these Irish gangs, they wear a proper overcoat, a big black proper overcoat with a big tall top hat. And they carry a baton, and mostly they carry a pistol underneath their jacket. Now these guys are big, and they're strong, and they don't mess around, and you don't want to cross them. And that's who's patrolling the streets in Boston and New York. They're not in uniform like the military, like Robert Peel's military or semi-military police were. These guys are not in uniform. They're wearing a big black overcoat with a big black top hat, and they're carrying a baton, and the pistol's probably in their pocket. Now, because of the corruption in the mayor's police in the city of New York, because of the legendary corruption between the mayor and these gangs of police, the governor of New York decides that he's going to hire a competing gang of Irishmen out of New York City, and they're going to come in and compete with the mayor's police. So for a while there, you actually have two legitimate government police forces openly fighting in the streets in New York City in a struggle to control which neighborhoods were served by which group of police, and which businesses were extorted from by each of the set of police. Because, see, the police did exactly what in the good neighborhoods the police did exactly what they did in the slums. All the businesses had to pay up, and the mayor took his cut, and that's how it was done, you see? So now, by 1850, the Irish gangs are the police in all the major eastern cities in America. By 1850, the Irish gangs are the police. They're used by the city bosses to bust heads, clear streets, break strikes, collect protection fees from the businesses, and enforce the vote in the slums. And that's the real key. You see, if the mayor's going to get reelected, he needs the slums to vote for him. And how are you going to get the slums to vote for you? You just call up the police chief, and they bust heads, and the vote comes out, and the mayor gets reelected, and that's how it's done. Now, at this point, I wanted to point out something about the movie The Gangs of New York. I really like that movie, and it's based on the book, The Gangs of New York, that I refer to in preparing for this series of podcasts. But in the movie, The Gangs of New York, I think it's important to point out that the gangsters were not poor. They were not dirty. They were not wearing ragtag clothing. They were gangsters. And you can always tell professional gangsters by their clothes, by their outfits. The Irish gangs were not about flash. They were about dominance. So again, they wore big black heavy coats, overcoats, and a big black top hat. And these were serious tough guys doing serious business. And you could, and you saw that when there was 8 or 10 or 15 of these guys walking down a street to clear a street, they made it clear what they were doing. You understood exactly what they were doing. And if you were, you know, an upright citizen, non-Irish, then you were fine. They wouldn't bother you. It almost didn't matter what you were doing. They wouldn't bother you. But if you were Irish and in the wrong neighborhood, you better expect to either run or get beat. So that was the real purpose of the police in the 1850s. Now let me jump back to Ireland for a minute, because I'm running out of time here. You can't tell the story of the Irish without mentioning the potato famine in some way. But I want to tell you, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but I want to tell you something. The potato famine was no accident. Yeah, the blight that hit was real. There was a real fungus that hit the potatoes. But this happened all across Europe. The poor people all over Europe had been depending on potatoes. Think of the famous painting, The Potato Eaters. Potatoes were the staple food for the poor all across Europe. Well, I shouldn't say the poor. They were the staple food for poor farmers. They were not the staple food for the poor in cities. They were what farmers grew to feed themselves. And then everything else the farmer grew, he grew to sell to the markets. But they grew potatoes to feed themselves. But now, the blight was all across Europe, but it hit Ireland differently. And the reason it hit Ireland differently, because it was used as an excuse by the English government. It was a contrived emergency, and it was used for ethnic cleansing in Ireland. That's exactly what took place. And there's a lot of other scholars that have worked on this. I'm not going to lay it all out for you in this little time frame that we have here. During the worst starvation of the potato famine in Ireland, there were ships full of rye, wheat, oats, full of sheep and cattle that left Ireland and went to feed the English farmers and feed the English countryside. So there was plenty of food in Ireland. It was just controlled by the English nobility. And this was used exactly the way Stalin did in Ukraine. Parliament and Queen Victoria did this exact same thing in Ireland. The same thing Stalin did to the Ukraine. Victoria in Parliament did this to Ireland, what, 70 years earlier, 80 years earlier? The point was population control. They wanted to either ship those dirty Irish to America or starve them. It didn't matter. But there was too many Irish, and they were a threat to English control. And the population had to be dropped in Ireland for the English to maintain control. So the Irish could either leave or die. That was the choice. And the Ottoman Sultan at the time, being a good Muslim, thought that he should do the right thing. He thought that it would be sinful as a Muslim for him to let people starve when there was the wealth of the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Sultan loaded ships full of food and sent them to Ireland to try to alleviate the starvation. But you know what happened? The English fleet blockaded Ireland and sent the Ottoman ships back, refused the food. Now that's the truth of the matter. You can look that up for yourself. The English hated the Irish and feared them. So now let's jump back to America. This meant that the Irish began pouring into America in high numbers. And in America, the Irish were simply fodder for Lincoln's guns. In 1860, Lincoln put out conscription, and it hit the slums in the big cities in the North heavier than anywhere else. Conscription into Lincoln's war was aimed directly at the Irish slums. And you know what? The Irish rioted. So there was a solution. A solution was offered by the Irish leaders, by the community leaders. Remember those guys? Never trust a community organizer. The community leaders said, we have a solution. Join Lincoln's War. You get free war training. You're going to get to keep your guns when it's all over. And then we'll all pack up and go back to England, or we'll all go back to Ireland and fight the English. And that was the intent of many of the Irish soldiers. So they ran into Lincoln's War, and they supported Lincoln's War with the false hope that they would come out of that war with proper battle training and weaponry, that they'd be able to take back and free Ireland. But you know what? It didn't happen. Why is that? Because you never trust neighborhood organizers. They do not work for you. They do not work for the neighborhood. And so now we have this, we're past the 1860s and we hit the 1870s. From about 1870 to about 1900, there became an official separation between the gangs and the police. But they were still connected at the voting booth. They still, the mayor still worked with the community organizers, the gang leaders, and the slums were still forced to vote. Right in the same time, though, waves of Italian immigrants started hitting the American shores. Suddenly, the Irish were acceptable in proper society. Most of them had worked their way out of the slums and were now living in the proper parts of town. And now, all of a sudden, between 1870 and 1900, it was okay to be an Irishman. Irish were no longer the dirty savages. Irish had worked their way into proper society. But you still needed the police. And the slums were filling up with Italians. And so the police were not so much in the Italian neighborhoods. There were separate gangs for that. The police were in the good neighborhoods where the Irish now lived. And the police were there for what purpose? To keep those dirty Italians off the streets. Keep them beaten back into the slums where they belong. You see how that switched around? One gang came into power, pushed the others, and held power through violence. And that's how we got police in the cities of America. On January 19th of 1919, the 18th Amendment to the Constitution was officially passed, and alcohol prohibition began the following year. The gangs of America had official funding for their activity. They still extorted from businesses. They still ran numbers. They still had their rackets. But now they had real money. The gangs had real money. And once again, the gangs and the police were united in the same cause. You know why? Because policemen drink beer. And all of a sudden, the gangs and the police were back on the same side again. You see, there was never enthusiasm for prohibition among police. It's not like the war on drugs. Cops drink, but very few cops actually use, you know, marijuana or things like that. Some do, but mostly they think themselves above that. So what did prohibition bring? Prohibition reunited after 30 years of the gangs and the police being separated. Prohibition brought the gangs and the police back together. And it also took the power of the police out of the hands of strictly the Irish. And it spread it around. Because now anybody could be a cop. You know, it's really true in most of the 1800s in most of the big cities in North America. The only way you could be a cop is if you were Irish and if you were moved into it by... there was a series of things that took place, and you literally had to have a sponsor inside the police force, and you had to buy your way into the police in New York and Boston and places like this. It was a process. It was like buying into a club. That's how you became a policeman. And it was very much like moving up through the gang ranks, because it was moving through the gang ranks. That's exactly what it was. That's how they did it. That's how they did it in the gangs before there were police. And that's how they did it in the police once the police were legitimate. So now you have this connection, and you understand how the Irish gangs became the Irish police in the big cities. Now, that might be controversial, but the facts are all there, and you can find them. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for